We are about to do episode 029 with Chrissy Myers covering the Grit book. This is our deep dive book club, Loso True North, taking business owners and leadership teams to the land of awesome. That's right, all that good stuff. A little bit of Tom Petty intro. Love Tom Petty. What's the name of this song?
Love is a Long Road.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Off of Full Moon Fever, yep. Great album. So, yeah. So, Chrissy Myers, AUI.
AUI.
Best doggone insurance firm in Summit County,
Northeast Ohio.
West, east of the Mississippi. I almost said west.
Well, no, that was the wrong direction.
You need there to might get be some pretty good insurance companies east of the Mississippi.
We do have a compass here somewhere.
Yes.
Good agencies, yeah.
So, love talking with you about just about anything. We're really looking forward to seeing what you think about this book, Grit. Let's see if that's in our shot. Yes, it is.
Looks great.
Grit by Angela Duckworth. Of course, we've been talking about this for a while. We did a bit of an overview, and then we did a deep dive into part two. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we're doing now. Part two.
Part two.
There we go. It's getting a little turned around.
That's okay.
So part two is what? Growing Grit from Inside Out.
Mm-hmm.
So we figured you might know something about that.
Maybe a little. I don't know. It's honor. I'm honored that you think that.
Yes. So why do you think I think that?
I don't. I would say maybe from a discipline perspective, I tend to do things in a very structured way and pretty consistent. Consistency is something that I think sometimes mirrors grit, or it's part of grit, because we talked about.
Yeah. What's your StrengthsFinder profile?
So I am achiever, relator, discipline, arranger, significance.
Relator, so, discipline, arranger.
Arranger, significance.
Significance.
So achiever is the day starts at zero, and there is a score at the end of every day, so I must accomplish something. Huh.
I've never heard it put that way.
That's how I put it.
Hmm.
So I have to, I love to do, I love accomplishing things.
So day starts at zero, and at the end of the day, what does it need to be at?
I need to, for me personally, I need to have accomplished three things.
Huh.
I don't, and those three things can range. Yes. Those
do you write them down?
I do. In my planner.
Why did I even ask?
Why you ask?
Well,
consistency.
How do you decide what the three things are?
It depends on the day and depends on what's going on in my schedule. But usually there's something that will be driven towards what our goals are, either as a family or as an organization for the year. So I'm always working on something that's in those top three goals.
Are these your sticky notes that you've got
those
on your
Those are some of my sticky notes,
At the office?
Yes.
Do you have sticky notes at home?
No.
On the
I
wall?
I do not have sticky notes at home on the wall. I can do that. That's a really good...
All right.
Yeah. Oh. Wow. Okay.
Steve's going to kill
me. Steve's going to love that. Yeah. He's like, why are there sticky notes in our dining room?
Let's take some of those on. Well, so I don't know. I mean, I'm familiar with Achiever.
Mm-hmm.
I think I might have Achiever at number 11. I think that's my first executing strength in my suite. Out of 34, it's number 11.
So I have three: Achiever, Discipline, and Arranger. So Relator is my next one. That is, I value close relationships. Mm-hmm. Discipline is exactly what it says. I'm going to work. Make sure that I get things done consistently. Mm-hmm. Arranger is I will take things apart a million times until I find the most efficient way to do something.
Hmm. Yeah, I never knew what that meant.
I thought you were going to be a personal organizer.
Remember I told you?
Wedding planner or something
like that. Like professional closet
professional,
organizer.
Professional, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. Yeah,
is that your dream gig?
That is if I had to start all over again and someone's like, you can never sell insurance, you can never do HR, you must pick another position. I would do that. And I could only... like do things myself. I had to be my own. Yes.
Wow.
Professional organizer.
Yeah, I remember that.
I like watch hoarders and go, oh, so much fun.
Because you see them hoarding and you're like, I could really help out.
I think, well, I mean, there's the mental health aspect of it, but then there's also that if you let me organize that, I feel like I could make that more efficient. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
Oh yeah. I love those shows where people are, we're going to take everything out and put it in your front yard and we're going to figure out what we're getting rid of. I love that.
Oh man.
Give me a closet.
I'm sweating over here.
I would have to go on a trip and just be like, just don't tell me.
That happened one time. My aunt went to Disney World. She came back. I completely reorganized her house.
Wow. Did she know you were going to do
no,
that?
No, she didn't. It was a surprise.
Oh, wow.
And there were a few times where she called me. She's like, where's this? And I'm like, oh, it's over here. And she's like, okay. She was very appreciative because I cleaned everything top to bottom, put cool. everything. I mean, wow. she, yeah, it was cool.
So it ended up okay.
It ended up totally okay. So.
Well, significance. I don't know what significance. I mean, I know what the word means in English, but I'm not sure what the strength
so
of significance
is. It's kind of a different one. So there's arguments with significance in I like to be, you want to be in a room where it happens, where things of importance are happening or be connected to people who have influence. For me, significance is I want to be part of organizations or part of something that has an impact. So it needs to live beyond me and beyond the importance of who I am and into something greater. Now, the basement to significance becomes I have to be the single point of contact for any type of communication or any type of decision making. So that's when significance can go bad.
Yeah. So you like get freaked out if you're not pulled into stuff?
It can be. Or you want to make sure that like seats of political power, seats of community power, you want to be in those rooms, you want to be in those spaces. And it's the demand that I expect to be there as opposed to I would like to be there or be invited. So pushing yourself into the center as opposed to walking in gracefully. So that's the basement of significance.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of some of my why for my business is I tossed back and forth between significance and substance. And I chose the word substance, but it's kind of the same thing. Well, very similar words. I love doing this business because of being able to do things of significance or substance with folks where it's impacting businesses and people and lives and, you know, budgets and all that stuff and communities. It's a big deal. It's fun. It's way cooler than helping somebody figure out how to make donuts or how to, you know, I don't know, sell widgets or something.
Yeah.
Widgets are fine, but. But that's interesting. Significance. There's a bunch of StrengthsFinder strengths that are a little mystifying to me.
Me too.
So like harmony was one that popped up one time. I mean, so at first when you're like harmony, it's like, oh, everybody's happy. And, you know, you kind of have that like butterflies and unicorns and pixie dust kind of, at least I have that initial thought like, oh. It's flowery stuff.
I have that one towards empathy.
Yeah, right.
So
I
know.
So we had a...
That would be my second to last strength.
It's almost at the bottom, I think, for mine too. But we had a client, we have a client that we've done some work with over the years, and we often do a StrengthsFinder module just to, as a team health, let's figure out who's who and who's good at what. And it helps to kind of open up that conversation in a leadership team. And this particular person was nothing like unicorns, pixie dust, and butterflies. And harmony was their number one strength. I'm like, what? It mystified me. And that's when I said to myself, I don't think I understand what StrengthsFinder means by harmony.
Right.
You know, or maybe it's not quite the right.
Well, and the other piece to it, too, is it's not necessarily, if they're not living in that strength and they're living in the basement of that strength, then harmony doesn't look like harmony. Harmony looks like everybody's being a jerk. Like, why can't you get along with anybody?
Yeah. Well, so with this person, they had a really, really hard, and it was coming out in a unhealthy way. They had a really hard time actually changing anything that would be sticky, that would be uncomfortable. You know, firing people, holding people accountable, changing processes or product lines and that sort of thing.
Well, disrupting. Totally the basement of harmony.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but this person is very very gruff. And you know, I don't know, kind of like a what's that Alan?
I don't know what you're thinking.
I'm thinking of one of those, that old TV show from the 60s.
Archie Bunker?
Yeah. Yeah, he kind of reminds me of that that kind of guy. Just real gruff and...
Now, how did I guess that?
Yeah. What was his wife's name?
Edith.
Edith.
I'm singing the song in my head right now.
Yes.
I'll have to...
Oh, man. All in the Family? Is that what it's called? Yes. Oh, my gosh. I don't know how I remembered that. But Harmony. And imagine Archie Bunker in Harmony. And like, what? You know? So, anyway. It's Strength Finder is really powerful and interesting. You and I share Relator. I think Relator is my number four.
Okay.
And I explain that to folks as in, hey, I have three friends, and if one of them dies, I only have two. I very narrow. As far as like lifelong deep friends, I'm not like all over the map. You know, I'm pretty narrow.
Yeah.
I'm friendly, you know, and easy to be friends with, but I just don't have capacity for a lot of friends. Mm-hmm. I guess does that sound right for you?
It does, and I would say I use my relator skills in building relationships. I may not necessarily put people in the center of my inner sanctum and my friend world, but I can make a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the strength of relator is because you're able to build close relationships, you're also able, if you use the skill the right way, to make everyone feel like they are they are close to you.
Yeah. You're
naturally warm.
Yeah. You're good at being friendly.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, my number one is strategic. And then self-assurance.
Okay.
And then, which is an influencer.
Uh-huh.
And then strategic thinking. And then intellection is number three. So when it comes to getting things done, if I think about it, it's productive. Like that's how I do stuff, is I just think about it.
That gives me hives.
And he thinks out loud on a whiteboard.
Yeah, so whiteboarding and graphics and talking helps process all that.
So when we're working together, he's doing all this stuff and thinking out loud, and I'm just trying. I have to think internally
and Shane's,
process stuff, and we work very differently.
Yes,
yeah, it's good though.
Then relator, and then input. Okay. Then I have some others that are influencing and mostly influencing and strategic stuff.
Okay.
But I have a couple of relational ones in there. And then number 11 is get stuff done.
Which makes you a good coach.
Yeah, because I don't have to actually do anything. Exactly. I just have to think about stuff and go, hey, have you thought about this?
Could you flip it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I get people to feel bad or feel good and go do that now, okay?
Yeah. It's your turn to execute. You've come up with a strategy. Now go do.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. That's right. That's a sweet spot. Well, so grit. So we're talking about this morning and how we were trying to figure out how grit as a character quality, would you classify grit? How would you classify the word grit or the concept of, hey, that person's got grit? Like, what would you... that quality.
I would classify, I would say it's a character quality for consistent action over time to deal with whether it's a difficult situation or just a day-to-day. It's just the ability to continue to move forward. That's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah. Not going to quit.
Not going to quit within reason. Yep. Going to continue to do, even if it's hard or even if it's boring. I'm going to be consistent.
Yeah. I figured out for me, and we were talking about this earlier, but I forgot to mention this morning, slipped my mind, but if I don't understand how, and this ties into strategic for me, being my top whatever strength, if I can't see how the thing, whatever the work is that needs done, if I can't connect it to a long-term destination or a long-term why or a long-term where, I can't do it. I can't actually engage in it. It's just, I can't get like all fired up about it. But okay. if I can see how the thing fits into some, you know, 5-year plan or some, well, like, you know, owning this building, for example, when I bought the building 6 years, I'm like, man, I got a lot of work to do here. But I had in my mind how I wanted it all to turn out someday. And so I can then buckle down and work 3 weeks on this and 2 weeks on that and 6 weeks on that. And whether it's hot or cold or uncomfortable, like, I don't care. I can push through it. I can do, I can gin up grit to get through it. But if I don't, if I can't connect it to a big distant truth that makes sense, then I can't push through. I quit quick. I run out of stick really fast. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Which may or may, you know, may be good, I guess, at times. But there are a lot of good things I should be doing, but I can't connect it to some distant goal, and so I run out of gas. Mm-hmm. But I would guess that you would be better at sticking with things generally.
I tend to be fairly consistent. I would say, she asked again for grit, and I wrote a note down. I forgot to read it. But that's okay. Grit is the consistency of micro decisions every day to get me towards my goals. It's that, the sum of everything. Like when you talk about whether it is how you're going to eat or how you're going to take care of your, how you're going to exercise, it's making those decisions every moment, every day. And those micro decisions add up over the course of a lifetime. I'm kind of the opposite, where if someone tells me in 5 years, this is what it's going to look like, if I cannot distill into action somewhat how I'm going to get somewhere, I get paralyzed. So I have to have action plan around how to get somewhere. Or if they say simply, we need to do this, like we need to get our revenue up by $50,000 a month by the end of this year. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, these are the steps we're going to take to get there. I'm happy. Like, you give me a goal, I will shoot for it. But if you start saying, draw the road, like draw what you want it to look like in 10 years, that's where I tend to struggle because I'm not as strategic. I think it's one of my, I think it might be my seventh strength in StrengthsFinder. I'm not as strategic, but the thought is that I'm very consistent in the daily actions. So I will get somewhere over a long period of time simply because I'm continuing to move forward.
Do you have focus in one of your, do you remember in your top in, 8 or 10?
I don't know. Let me look.
I bet you do.
I'm going to look while we're sitting, while we're talking.
Discipline, focus, there's another one.
Because, you know, I've got it on my phone in an app.
Responsibility, I think. Isn't that one? Responsibility?
Oh, yeah. Responsibility is absolutely in my top 10.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds like you have five top fives, you know. Can we just get... what is that? Enneagram that has the wings and all that.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's kind of
analytical is my first strategic. So individualization, connectedness, competition, activator, analytical. So responsibility is 12. So, yeah.
Okay. I think my six is futuristic, I think. Command is in there somewhere.
Yeah, no. That's like 16. That's down.
I don't remember. Oh, learner, I think, is number 9 for me. I'm pretty sure. Which I found, like, learner and input, I mean, they go together, but input is more, at least kind of how I understand it. If you're high in input, that means you have a lot of hobbies. Like, you have a lot, you like to learn about things that are, at least how I understood it, a little more practical things or hands-on things.
Yes.
And I do. I have like 14 hobbies.
My husband's like that.
Yes, it sounds like that.
Absolutely. I was like, input is in his top 5. So when I had him take StrengthsFinder, I was for a birthday present like 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was like, if you love me, you will take this assessment. Yeah. So he did, and found out that his strengths are mostly strategic, and he doesn't have any executing strengths in his top 5. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, now I understand why we struggle with some of this stuff.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. My wife has a lot of executing and relationship stuff. Restorative is her number 1, which I think is an executing strength.
It is.
Right?
It is. Yeah, I'm looking. Yep. I'm looking at it right now.
I've heard like mechanics are often restorative is, because they're just like, well, you got to get this thing back to how it should be working.
Back the way it needs to be. Yep.
And then give me the next one. Yeah.
Yeah, she should fix
it. Well, no, she can't. No. But she does fix other stuff, like relational stuff. She's all about that.
Well, she fixed, yeah, she fixed people.
Yes, she loves fixing people. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, so one of the things I'm struggling with grit, I love the book. Well, do you love the book? I mean, what do you think about it? So you're done reading the book.
I'm done reading the book.
What's your general takeaway so far?
For me, it was validation on some of the things that I do normally. I liked it. It was nice to see that there's scientific research around consistency in some of the things that we do, how people train, how to parent, how to build culture within your organization. So I liked it. I think that it kind of flies a little in the face of the work-life balance people at times. There are a few things that she talked about with like the average amount of work that she spends in a week doing. So I was like, it's a little different from some of the things that I've been reading more recently and I've been working on, but I think it was the reminder really to practice purpose. So I liked it. I thought it was, it spoke to my very project oriented soul.
Yeah.
So
I feel like I have, and we're very different and also similar in that, you know, big projects, big things we're trying to get done or big, working with people that are getting big things done. That stuff doesn't freak me out, doesn't freak you out, all that. We have really different ways of actually getting it done, I think. But this book spoke to me as well from a different angle. And that's why I'm so interested in what you think about it, because we come at things so differently. I know for me, it's been a welcome challenge. I don't know if I had read this 20 years ago. It's one of the things, of course, I want to ask you is, how would this have changed your, if you had learned this 20 years ago and accepted it, how would you be different now?
I mean, I think that I would have, so let's think, 20 years ago, more validated around consistency for the long haul, kind of looking at life and accomplishment as in it's not necessarily planting, like you're not necessarily planting vegetables for a harvest that's going to be a year. You're planting a tree. So kind of looking at grit as, you know, it takes time. You have to water it. You have to put forth the effort. You have to prune. So I would say maybe reading this book could have mentally prepared me for some of the things that I had to do in business transition, more as a business owner. I think I would have appreciated having some of it from a parenting perspective too, especially as a parent. I mean, I think that would be helpful. I think the parenting section was very, was interesting for me.
It was a little awkward in some ways, because you're like, uh-oh, I think I screwed my kids up.
I've got time, yes. I can fix it.
Touchy. So. Very touchy. Well, so for me, this, if I had accepted this content 20 years ago, I would have, I think I would be more productive now. I think I would have muscled through some things that were good for me that I didn't because I was bored or unenvisioned or something. Also I relied on things I was good at more than, and that's one of my big takeaways from this book is, being productive doesn't mean you're good at something. It means really more that you're taking something you're good or pretty good or marginally good. That's kind of irrelevant, and just pushing through the hard stuff.
Yeah.
And that's something that I never accepted very readily. Or if I had accepted it more, I think I'd be in a way better place now. Not that I'm complaining, but.
No, I mean, Josh and I talked this morning, Josh Gordon, talked today about variety versus vocation, because you talk about something with serial entrepreneurs, you know, are they gritty? And you would think, yeah, they absolutely have to be gritty, but they're constantly moving from one thing to the next. Are they really being consistent? And it's the looking at, it's not necessarily the fact that they're doing so many different things. It's that they're doing this, they're doing different things with the same intention and the same process. So we talked about like variety over vocation. So it may be a little bit, your vocation may be changing constantly. Yeah. What you're doing may be changing constantly as you're coaching, but you're still doing the same thing. So
That
was kind of a thought.
She had said in there somewhere, I don't remember what part it was in. Maybe it was in part two. Going from a job to a career to a calling.
Yes.
That was really powerful.
That was very powerful. I feel like that spoke to me a lot.
Yeah, and I think youngsters, you know, when they're, and I'm a youngster, 20s, 30s, whatever, teens, and they're going, well, what should I be when I grow up? My kids have all, well, my kids are a little bit older, I guess, than yours. My oldest is 30-something, 31, and 19, my youngest. And we've gone through these, like, what should I be when I grow up, Dad? And I'm like, I don't know. I mean, but I got about, I don't know, 30 ideas, you know, and less or less list them all out. And I'll, you know, whiteboard them and all this stuff and tools and all that galore stuff. But the but this progression here is like, well, and this is what I told my kids, too, is you don't really need to worry about your career, I don't think, early. I think it's important to get good at some things, but to not paint yourself in a corner, like with some degree that is limiting. You want a degree, I think, that is creates opportunities rather than narrows opportunities, because folks figure out later in life what they really are good at and what they really want to do. That that combination, it's kind of rare that people figure that out early and stick with it.
Well, and I have another entrepreneur friend, he's out in California, and he talks about when he was younger, you know, the don't be afraid to take really big swings when you're young, because you have the capacity to start over. You still have, and I mean, even in your 40s, you still have the capacity. I mean, in the 50s, you can still start over. I mean, that's but it's just really when you're in your 20s and 30s, you've got the ability to kind of, you don't necessarily have the same trappings of wife, husband, family, all of the things that, that tie you into something that requires as much, a larger financial engine than what you would have. So you can take those bigger swings. You can make those larger investments. You can take that that job at a startup that you may not necessarily take when you're 55 and you've got to deal with 401k and college educations that you're paying for. And I would say too, with the book, I like the, what would I have done differently in my life? But at the same time, like, as I think as we get into middle age, it's, we're naturally reflective. I don't know if I would have made any different decisions as much as I think, would the book have made any major impact in my life? I don't know, because I tend to be that consistent, disciplined person. I don't know that it would have changed anything other than I might have decided to stick into some things that I probably shouldn't have. I think that there's a component of discernment that you have to have around grit, because there's, I think, a fine line between being gritty and insanity and continuing to do something that's over and over is going to cause a problem for you in the long run.
Yeah, just because you're sticking with something doesn't mean it's a good idea.
Exactly.
You know, it could, it might be a bad idea to keep at some, well, to keep at something that's a bad idea is a misuse of gittered on grittiness. I don't know what part of this is growing grit from the inside out. I think that that where she talked about the career, job to career to calling, I think it was in part two.
Yeah,
I'm not exactly sure where, but she referenced that. What was it the brick the mason?
Yes,
you remember that, where the, you know, the one brick, you go to a job site and you ask the one guy, hey, what are you doing? Oh, I'm laying bricks.
Laying bricks.
What are you? The next guy, hey, what are you doing? I'm building this church.
Yep.
And then the next guy's like, oh, I'm building the house of God. Like, there's, yes. It's this vision. It's just more of like a calling. It's more of an overarching, like, cool, that's a big uh-huh. deal. And I think this is around this either hope or what was the other one? So it's interest, practice, purpose.
Yes.
And hope, the four areas of growing grit from inside out.
Yes.
So it must have been around sense of purpose.
It was purpose. I feel like once you hit the purpose point with grit, I think that's where it all kind of comes together. I think that's really the magic. Yeah. To me, that's the secret sauce of growing your grit, is finding that purpose. I mean, like for us, for AUI, it's like we sell insurance. No. And it's like, no, we support small businesses. And then purpose is, no, we provide peace of mind by simplifying the complicated. So it's really looking at, you know, this is what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she kind of defines purpose as external from yourself, helping or developing folks, or whether specific or general folks, like, hey, I just want to help children, or hey, I want to help the community, or I want to help these kind of people, but it's outside of you.
Yes.
It's way more than, hey, I just want to be awesome or be successful or something. And it's been really interesting working with clients that have a latent sense of purpose, but they don't have a clear, overt, outward, tangible sense. They have a hard time kind of putting into words, here's why we're doing this. You know, that's wholesome and warm.
Yeah.
You know, and outward. So I like that. What about interest? Did any of that kind of interest conversation in the book spark you?
As far as like growing your...
Yeah. Like, you know, moving from, like, first of all, going, hey, I'm going to get... Has this happened with you where you said, I'm going to work really hard on this thing because I'm interested in it, because it's triggers my... happy place.
Oh, because of passion. Absolutely. I think especially in the community aspect of the work that I've done from a volunteer perspective, that is definitely more of interest and passion than it is in vocation. Hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Especially in the mental health space. Hmm.
What about the practice piece? Any of the practice stuff? That one of the things that really jumped out to me is that practice is that there are a lot of people that have figured out a lot of stuff about practice that are smart, you know, that's the word I'm looking for, scientists,
yes.
You know, researchers, not just going, hey, it's a good idea to practice, and there's a smart way to practice and a dumb way to practice, you know, that's
understood. Yeah. I mean, but with deliberate practice, when she talks about you're going to do this intentionally, I look at deliberate practice now as a business owner. For me, it is maintaining my routine. So maintaining my routine in the morning and how I get up and how I set my mindset, because that sets me for the day, and then being consistent in our goal setting and our measuring. I mean, that's deliberate practice, and we're going to consistently create new goals and metrics that we need for every year, and then we're going to break that down into quarters, we're going to break that down into months, and then be consistent on our purpose and making sure that we are going through this in a specific and measured process. So I think that sometimes I think as business owners, we overthink it. In like, when we talk about deliberate practice, we're thinking, oh, I've got to go run a marathon, or I've got to train for it. We can silo it into something very specific. And I think with sports, it's really easy to do that. As opposed to when we're looking at growing grit from the inside out, when we're looking at our business lives, I mean, really, it's just about creating the right routine and sticking to it.
Yeah, it's scary how little, and from my perspective anyway, working with all these different companies, how foreign that idea is of, hey, you can't get good at something without practicing it.
Yeah,
you know. So, for instance, picking on like a visionary. You got this vision, huh? Yeah. What is it? Well, you know, I kind of, sort of, I think I feel like, you know, it's like, no, dude, stop. You need to work this out and practice it and talk to yourself and elevator speech it and go over it and over it and over and over it and refine it until it comes out naturally. Now, it's in there naturally, but it's not coming out naturally.
Yes.
You know, and one of the things professionals do is they practice. The amateurs just don't practice.
No.
You know, like, hey, you're a professional business operator. You need to practice the fundamentals of operating a business. You know, if you were a professional golfer or, you know, cello player or whatever, you'd practice scales, right? Day in and day out. And are you good at scales? Yes, I am. Why you practice? Well, because all the music I do stands on top of that, you know, and it's the same thing with business stuff. So that was very interesting to me. The code to how to practice or what good practice looks like. Mm-hmm. From music school, I remember seeing some folks that would just practice what they were good at. And this is the one place that I kind of got it, the practice piece. I mean, we had to practice a lot, you know, and when you're in performance school, it was like 3 hours a day on your instrument. I mean, that was pretty much like a given.
Minimum.
Yeah. And then we're taking piano, so that's another hour a day of that. And then, shoot, I don't know what else. But anyhow, I would watch people practice things that they could already do, and they wouldn't practice the stuff they couldn't do.
Yeah.
Or like the transitions between things.
Like I'm afraid to suck at something new.
Yeah, and it's painful to practice the things that are you know, dodgy. You know what I'm saying? And then I watch them just like, well, for instance, practice being nervous, you know, practice, you know, the putting yourself in the mindset of, oh, I'm nervous and I've got this adrenaline going and all that stuff. And so I got in the habit of figuring out how to recreate those situations where my adrenaline would come up and I'd forget stuff and get jumpy. And that practicing that situation made it so I could plow through the hard parts when it got down to it. But I noticed a lot of people didn't do that. And so in this section of deepening grit through practice, that was really interesting to me how there has to be, first of all, like a real stretch goal. Like I'm doing it this way and I want to get to this way or this fast or these few mistakes or, you know, some clear finish line or clear ceiling you're going to hit. Not just mindlessly practicing and getting in this just like rhythm of just da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da over and over, but really kind of doing it and then looking at it going, wait, now what just happened? How did I?
Yeah.
Did I mess this up? Did I mess that up? And very carefully looking at it. That's something I see a lot with business owners, that they don't do that. They have, you know, they'll sit there and go, hey, blah, 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 to some leadership team member. And I'm sitting there looking at that member and I'm saying, I don't think that guy realizes that he just freaked that person out, you know? And it's his job to lead that person. I'm like, buddy, you bonehead. You got three people to lead and you just freaked them all out.
Yeah.
Do you know that? Like, do you know anything about people? You know, that's his day job, is to learn about people and to lead people. So I would call that like zero attention to feedback. And then, you know, repeating process, that's a big one. Deliberate practice with grit. I love the spelling bee thing. I figured when I was reading that, I thought you would really enjoy the spelling bee thing.
Spelling bee.
Yes. Did you do spelling bee stuff?
I did once. So I was not the big spelling bee person. I did speech and debate.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. Debate.
And I danced. So I was a competitive tap dancer. Hmm. So that's kind of when you talk about like growing grit initially, like the early early events in your life, it was dance.
How
it was
do you
drama.
Practice debate? What does that look like?
So it was speech and debate. So I did prose poetry and then I did some other events. And then I did policy debate in college, but the majority of what I did was it was the same program. And so it was, how do you deliver it?
So it's more around a diction, emotion,
eye contact, presentation, eye contact. Yeah. So that was in high school, that was what I did. And I did some theater events. But then in college, I did policy debate. And policy debate was, you prepared for it by continuing to research all of the different arguments for the policy. And it would take like weeks. And you'd have a piece of paper with an argument and an article, another piece of paper with an argument and an article. And so it really became more of how fast can you talk and how quickly can you pull the information that you've already put in a file. So that policy debate was consistent reading of material to be able to, when someone came up with an argument, you had to have a counter argument to it very quickly. So that was...
That's interesting. I would have a really hard time with that.
And it required a ton of attention because, I mean, because I was at John Carroll, I would get up in the morning and I would go to the speech and debate office at like 6 a.m. because I knew that I would have time by myself. And I'd take like 3 hours and I'd research all the different policies. I'd put them in categories and then I would go to class and then somebody else would come in and they'd read those policies and see like if my arguments were correct and if they liked where they were filed and if they didn't, they'd move them. Cause I was on the low end of the totem pole and on the debate team. Mm-hmm. I did policy debate as a freshman and sophomore. So I didn't do it consistently. I was more like the researcher. I'd pull the information together. I didn't really want to have to be on stage at that point in time. I wanted my weekends to myself. So
yeah,
I was happy to be the research nerd.
Yeah. Research is tough for me. I mean, that's your analytical. It's got to be that strength of yours.
Well, and I feel like it was also that achiever piece where it's like I could quantify what I was doing for the team.
Okay.
Because I was pulling so much information together for them to use.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
As you've gone through this book, have you had any kind of takeaways where you said, I'm going to do this thing differently in my business now? Anything pop up where you're like, doggone, I got to change that.
I got to change it. I think it's that reminder to make sure that we're practicing our purpose intentionally. That was kind of the reminder for me in Grit, but then also kind of introducing the concept to the organization again of consistency. I feel like we, because of the nature of what we do with insurance and HR, we have to be naturally consistent. We follow the same processes and procedures. In the insurance industry, if we don't, there could be a violation in policy. Someone could maybe be uninsured, or we could commit, I mean, you can commit a crime and go to jail. So I don't ever want to have to pay a fine because we didn't do something the right way. So I would say it's just reintroducing the concept of why it's so important for us to practice throughout the year, look at our processes, make sure we're doing things the most efficient way possible, because we have, like, we're in a busy time of year right now. It's our busiest time of year, and we kind of train for it for the for a period of time. And I know that a lot of our legacy staff knows that, but some of the people that are newer, this is kind of, it's different for them. They're like, why all of a sudden is nobody talking to each other? It's like, we went from doing 5 policies a week to 500 policies a week. So it's like looking at like, what does that number look like? So like the volume has gone, it's increased by 1,000. So
yeah,
I think reintroducing the concept of consistency is probably something that we'll be working on. And that understanding of deliberate practice. I mean, if we're going to be good in our sales force, if we're going to be delivering a consistent message, we need to practice that more. We need to be willing to kind of stink at things that are new so that we can get better at it.
Yeah, that's interesting. The practice of processes, practice of, hey, here's how we're going to do this from step A to B to C to D. Have you ever read about or know anything about Danny Meyer, the restaurant guy in New York City?
I don't think so.
I think he started Shake Shack, which is kind of a franchise now.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And there's some other ones. I don't remember the names of them. That's the only one that he sold off as a franchise, I think because of COVID. But anyway, he's really good at that. He's really good at that idea of taking, hey, here's this big why. Here's why we're doing this thing for this client. And then requiring, maybe is a little strong, but he's really intentional about training all of the wait staff, mm-hmm. all of everybody
yeah.
around, here's all these ways we're going to do this, and here's why, and I'll practice. Now show me.
Yeah.
I'm not going to let you out on the floor until you go through this regimen of training that's yeah. very robust. And he had a story in, this was in, I think this was in Culture Code.
Okay.
What's the guy's name? Can't remember. Dan Coyle? Daniel Coyle?
Yeah.
I think it is. Where a senator, a U.S. senator, walks into one of his restaurants in New York City, and they're all different, they're not the same, they're not franchised restaurants. They're all very different restaurants, different menus, different price points, different locations in the city, all this stuff. And anyway, senator walks in, senator has his guest, senator sits down, out comes a salad, and there's this bug, this beetle on the salad, you know? And the waiter's like, oh, shoot, you know, and takes the salad back and brings him another one. And everything's fine. Next day, the senator, same senator, goes into a different Danny Meyer restaurant and totally different management, all that stuff. And the waiter brings out a salad, different, you know, totally different waiter, totally different, but it's the next day, all right? And there's this little piece of paper on the salad, and it said Ringo on it. And the senator's like, why is there a piece of paper on my salad that says Ringo? And the waiter goes, oh, we just wanted to let you know that that restaurant you were at yesterday isn't the only restaurant that has beetles on their salad. And the guy's like, how did you do that? Like, how did you know that? You know, and that's Danny Meyer driving practice
yeah.
around simple micro processes that get the client to go, man, I love coming here.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's he had said as a, I don't know when he said this, but he said, life and business is all about how we make people feel. It's mm-hmm. that simple and it's that difficult. You know, and at the end of the day, that's our job as business owners to go, hey, you're, you know, missing something. I'm going to give it to you. And you're going to go, oh, thanks. I'm so happy now. Or I'm something satisfied. And we forget that that's our job, is to get our clients to have a great feeling of yeah. some sort. So anyway, I love the practice piece. Huge missing element, I think, in business.
Yeah.
So as you've been reading along here,
mm-hmm.
What sort of things in your life have been grit generating that maybe, so we're talking about generating grit from the inside out, yeah. specifically in part two, anything in your life where you can look back and go, yeah, that really helped. That thing in my life made it so that I was good at sticking.
I was good at sticking to things. I mean, I would say, early Chrissy, like growing up, it was dance. It was being mm-hmm. consistent mm-hmm. on things. I mean, it was.
Did you have a good coach? I mean, did you have a?
I had phenomenal coaches. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I competed. I was a national tap dance champion. Mm-hmm. I had great teachers.
And what style? Like, I mean, are there a lot of tap dance like? Genres?
So at that time, no, it was just tap. I mean, now there's like different, I want to say there's more like the traditional, like...
Like Fred Astaire.
Fred Astaire type tap, yeah. like Gene Kelly, and then there's yeah. more of that like gritty tap, where it's more like a street...
rock and roll, or, well...
Yeah, like, let's try to think. Savion Glover, Bring the Noise, Bring the Funk. He was in, it was a Broadway show that he started... And it was around like spoken word and mm-hmm. more of like that street tap mm-hmm. That was popular in the late 90s. But that was coming in right as I was finishing up my dance career. Mm.
So you think dance, like being in group, well, how did you get tied into that? I mean, at what age did you?
So I started when I was 2.5. I was a klutz. And the thought was, if you want to be able, if she needs to learn how to fall gracefully. Huh. Was kind of the thought. My mom was like a national baton twirling champion. Mm. And I think that she was terrified to give me a stick. so I twirled for a while because she taught baton when I was little. And then she, I want to say she stopped teaching when I was like 5 or 6. And she didn't, for some reason, well, not for some reason, she didn't want me to twirl baton as much, I think, because she wound up with really severe arthritis in her hands. Okay. So because of that, I was a tapper. So I took tap dance. I did ballet. I did all the musical theater stuff. But tap was my favorite. So I started at 2.5, and I danced until I graduated from high school. So
what's that? There's a show choir down in the valley in Akron.
ETC?
Yes, ETC.
ETC.
Were you part of that?
I was not. I was not. I went to CVCA, so I did musical theater there, speech and debate, and then dance. Yeah. And dance took up a significant part of my time because, I mean, I had training, and I was in groups, and then I did solos and duets. And so at any given year, I was doing 2 to 6 numbers competitions on the weekend. Yeah. So I would do speech and debate on Saturdays. I would do dance competitions usually on Sundays, and those would kind of fluctuate back and forth. And then I had theater. I mean, I was busy.
Did your folks kind of make you, or was it a joint venture?
No, the only thing they made me do was take piano. And then when piano became an option, and they said, you can choose dance or piano. I said, oh, I choose dance because I don't like piano. Piano lessons are important. They're great for cross-brain development and math. I forced my children to take piano, too. And I think that the one would love to quit, but we won't let him yet.
Yes.
So we're like, no, this is important for your brain development, so you're doing it.
I love piano.
Oh, Shane.
Did you like taking lessons?
I learned a lot.
I like people that can play the piano. I mean, Madeline, I mean, Maddie and Caleb, they both do a decent job. Madeline's gifted at the piano at this point, but it's because she's so consistent in how she practices.
Yeah.
And that is not a mom doesn't push the practice thing. That is a dad pushes the practice thing. So, I mean, when Steve came along, he's like, your kids are taking piano lessons, soon to be our kids. And I was like, yeah, but I mean, he's like, you don't make them practice? I'm like, no, because really studies have shown as long as they are practicing for 30 minutes a week, he's like, you're paying for piano lessons and they're not practicing? Are they getting any better? I'm like, I don't care. I just want that 30 minutes. Oh, no, now they're good. So he's far more disciplined when it comes to certain things than I am. But he came from
teaching. It's so weird.
I know. I married someone who's more regimented in certain areas than I am. Yeah. So
is he regimented, or is he good at getting other people to be regimented?
I would say, he's going to listen to this, Mark. I would say that he can be very consistent.
Yeah.
And then he can choose to not be consistent. It's all or nothing with him.
Yeah.
So I think I'm probably very similarly wired. I don't like to have. I'm either going to go at 100 miles an hour, or I'm not going to do it at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yes.
Well, all right. So speaking of your kids, as you're reading this book, have you said to yourself, oh, I'm going to parent differently. I'm gonna do that thing differently or more of that thing. Like what has popped out of this in a parent sense?
Yeah, I would say for me, it's the reminder to focus on the warmth part, the support part. I know that I'm very structured. Steve is very structured. We're a structured family with a purpose, a mission statement, and core values. I mean, like we are, we're on it. But making sure that we don't dip down into authoritarian parenting, that we are more of that, the book says, a wise parent. I liked what she talked about when she talked about the differences with whether it's political ideology or just the structure of your family. You can be a hippy dippy family and still be a wise parent. You can be a very structured religious family and still it doesn't have to look the same. There's no one set model. So I would say that moving towards wise parenting, I think that growing up, my parents were fairly, I would say they were wise parents. They were in that wise parenting space.
Quadrant.
Authoritarian parent at times, probably when I was a teen. I think when I was in junior high and high school, I thought there were moments that they were authoritarian. They were not. Now as I look back, I'm like, wow, I was just a snot.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to take any kid, any person really, and kind of go, hey, what do you think? What do you see? How are you feeling? What's your opinion?
Yeah.
And you know, it's like, okay, here's how I feel right now.
Yeah.
Or here's what seems most important to me right now. And that could be a really incomplete answer or a really, you know, squashy answer.
Well, and as I'm looking at, I mean, specifically, when I was listening and reading to the book, there was a lot of lens around my daughter. So Maddie's 14, and it was thinking about, you know, I think as far as grit goes, she's an extremely gritty person. I mean, she does not give up on much. She's extremely dedicated, extremely focused. And my concern is as we shape that path for her to make sure that her grit doesn't get into obsession. So how do we make sure that we don't cross the line into that more obsessive, compulsive, I have to do this, as opposed to I want to do this or I get to do this, I should. So,
yeah. I thought it was really interesting how she talked about the difference. And it was a little nuanced, but the kind of the difference between authoritarian and authoritative. I wish she had gotten a little more into that, but
it
kind of, to me, the takeaway of authoritative, and that kind of got my attention also. I'm like, wait, whoa, authoritative is good. Authoritarian is bad, at least the way she stated it.
Well, I like to think of it as with authoritative, it is, this is the expectation. I want you to do this. I'm cheering for you to do this. And I'm going to encourage you. If you don't make the mark, I still love you. I still care for you.
Yeah.
We may need to work on some things, but I'm still your mom. I'm still your dad. And I think with authoritarian, do I still get love and affection from you and care from you if I don't hit that mark? And I think that that's the big difference between authoritative and authoritarian. And authoritative, that love is always, I will always love you. I will always support you, whether you hit the mark or you don't hit the mark. But I expect you to freaking hit it. That's kind of where I see the rub. And that's where I want to parent. But I don't think it looks, I think for individuals who don't parent in any type of authoritative or authoritarian way, I think it's very difficult for them to see that.
Yeah, to see either one.
Yes, because it looks, I mean, I don't want to say abusive is not the right word, but they kind of look at it like, why are you holding your child to that expectation? Why are you even putting rules around? Why are you, I mean, and then from a grand, I think I told you, I think that a lot of grandparents, depending on what's going on with an authoritative parent, would say, oh, it's just like, you can't do that. Why are you?
Yeah.
That's my grandbaby. So
yeah,
I do not have an authoritative, a wise authoritative grandparent in my mother. She's just squishy now, and that's okay.
Yeah. That's fun.
Yeah.
It's the grandparenting thing is a different, it's a different gear. I have a 5-year-old, a couple of 2-year-olds and a 8-month-old grandkids, so 5 grandkids. And I see them a lot, and it's a different mode for sure for me and for my wife. My wife's doing really well. Well, I think I am too, I guess. But it's been really fun to watch her she's a good grandmom, whatever. I'm jealous of those little kids. You know, I'm like, man, wish I had a grandma like that. You know, and I tell her that too. I'm like, you're crushing this. You're doing a great job. You know, well, so when she talked about the authoritative, one of the things that kind of like jumped out for me was this idea that, hey, this is my space as an adult, as a parent, as a, you know, spouse, whatever. Talking about kids, and if I don't have a strong, like, non-negotiable border, I'm actually mailing in my world here. You know, kind of going, if I let you, you know, blah, blah, blah with food or blah, blah, blah with our stuff or whatever, like, I'm being a bad steward. So it's authoritative to me is kind of like, hey, my job is to raise you and have you be healthy.
Yes.
And mature.
Yes.
And so I'm going to do that. And whether you like it or not, you know, I'm, but authoritarian would be more like, you're bugging me, you're annoying me, I don't like how you act, and so I'm going to make you act differently because it just fits my worldview.
You're doing this because I said so.
Yes.
Which, there is no, that's right. There's no question. That's there's right. no debate. Authoritative parenting, I think, has the potential to be very exhausting because yes. you're also enabling your children to say, why?
Yes.
I'm not saying I'm not doing it. Just yeah. tell me why.
I want to understand it.
Oh, my sure. gosh. I mean, I think the hardest part
yes.
for me right now, having a 14-year-old daughter, is yeah. we want her to be able to create her own boundaries, and we want her to be able to yeah. never be afraid to ask for what she
yeah.
wants.
Yeah.
But my gosh, yeah. there are moments where I'm like, I just want to be like, do it the way I'm telling you to do yes. it, because I've lived your life, and I've been in your, like, I've been a 14-year-old girl, and I can't yeah. do that. And yeah. that's
doesn't thank, work very yeah, well.
No,
does it?
Thank God I can tag team out. I'm like, Steve, it's
yeah.
your turn.
Yeah.
So
tag you're it. Right?
We do. We tap in and out when it comes yeah. to those arguments because, again, yeah. you're training someone to yeah. to be gritty. Mm. So you want to have yeah. a gritty kid.
Yeah.
You got to be willing to be patient. Oh, yeah. It's so hard. It's so hard.
Yeah, that's great. What do you, well, this is one of the things I was dying to ask you about
Uh-oh.
Grit. As I'm reading along and I'm thinking, oh, what the heck would Chrissy say about this? And it's from as an HR person.
Okay.
And as a boss, business owner, mm-hmm. someone who interviews and hires and manages people and all that. What do you think a good way to interview for grit is? I mean, well, yeah. so let's back up. Okay. Is it a good idea for our employees to be gritty, in your opinion, generally speaking?
Generally speaking, yeah. I would say you want some component of grit.
Yeah, like not yeah. one, not on the grit scale of one. One would be like not at all gritty.
Yeah, you don't want, yeah, you want like a higher grit sandpaper. You don't necessarily want like super grit, but you probably want mm-hmm. like that, yeah, that medium where they're going to stick to something. They're going to be consistent, because if they're not mm-hmm. consistent, if they're not gritty in any way, then I would be concerned that they're not going to even show up for work.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that part mm-hmm. of grit is just showing up. Yeah. So yeah, I would think very simply, you want gritty employees.
Yeah. Well, so there's this grit scale.
Yes.
Which is interesting, and that's part of the foundation of her work. Where is that? Page, what was it? 50-something?
54.
Yeah.
Around those mid-50s. 50-something. Yeah.
And we took that. We talked about that a little while back. Yeah, it's 55.
Okay.
So it's scale of 1 to 5, and you come out of there with 5, you're like doggone gritty.
Yeah.
And if yes. you come out of there with a 1,
super grit.
You got like a noodle spine, I guess, right. or something. Yeah. I don't know. Well, so somewhere between like middle range grit?
Yeah, I would say
between 2 to 4?
Yeah, between 2 and 4. I would say if you're more than 4,
you're going to be hard to manage.
Well, you may want to know something? not necessarily, as long as you know what's the role that you're hiring for. I mean, if you're mm-hmm. hiring for an operations manager or a CEO, mm-hmm. I think you absolutely want that person to be gritty.
Yeah.
But if you're hiring for like the receptionist who's going mm-hmm. to be just, I mean, and not even that, I think that it's position based. I don't think mm-hmm. that everybody needs to have a high level of grit mm-hmm. to be successful, because mm-hmm. you can grow it. I mean, that's what the book says, right? So mm-hmm. I would say 1 would scare me, mm-hmm. but if anywhere between 2 and 4, I think is great. Hmm. I mean, I think average is fine
yeah.
in this situation.
Well, so we were talking, and one of our compadres who we hope to have on the show sometime, John Stevens, was saying, well, in an interview, if you ask somebody these questions, it'd be real easy for them to just like BS their way to a 5 or whatever.
Oh yeah, I think this. Or, yeah, I mean, sure. those are leading questions.
Yeah.
I think that's
well. How would you do it? Like, give me an example of how you would interview in such a way to figure out if somebody was gritty.
Okay, so example for interview. So you would need to know first what the role would be. So you
well,
talk
let's pick
about.
One. Let's pick just one. Say I don't know, assistant. Let's just let's
how
say
about training and development manager.
Okay,
that's a good
it.
One. Okay. So if you're dealing with someone in the C-suite and they're going to be responsible for training and development, they're going to be responsible for some business development, and they're going to be responsible for managing some client relationships. So I would say client manager. Okay, so we'll look at that. in that role, these are the things you're going to want. And then you're going to start asking how. So they're really how questions. So your resume tells me that you were in training and development for X organization. Tell me something that you did, or tell me how you would manage creating a training structure for a new, let's say it's a CPA, a new accountant. So we're hiring in new accountants. How would you train them to do what you do? And then the answer to the question will give you some of the indications as to whether or not they've really done it or they haven't. So generally when someone's giving you an answer to a question and they are talking more academic, they probably have never done it. If they're using more of an example with, well, in my past I did X. We created a training program that had six modules. We did YouTube videos. We did, and they go very specific into it. Then you can kind of write those things down. And then 3 questions later, go back and say, hey, even if you're asking the same question again, or you reframe it in a different way, let's go back to that training and development question. So you said you used YouTube. How did you do that editing? How did that work? So you're asking more of those drill down detail questions. If they go back and they can't give you that answer, then chances are they're BSing you. So you're able to kind of go back through, get that second ask for clarity. If it goes to academic and it's an academic answer, then chances are they didn't do it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, so she defines grit as perseverance and passion generally. And in this test, this part's testing for passion to see if you're passionately going to push through and do stuff because you're super into it.
Yeah.
My interests change from year to year. Not at all. Not much. Sometimes. Most of the time. All the time. You know? So all the time be like, yeah. Which would mean you're not very passionate. So you'd be low on the grit score in the passion section. So how would you pitch that to somebody if you're trying to find out, look, are you like really excited about something and you stick with it, or do you just hop around from thing to thing and you kind of like don't ever buckle down?
I think some of that you can see focused. Possibly in resume. You can see if they're a career butterfly. You could also ask around hobbies. Tell me about something that you're, what do you like to do in your free time? Yeah. And someone says, oh, I love to go hiking. Okay, well, have you done, if you're local, have you done the hiking spree? Have you done, and you ask some of those additional questions to get more clarity. How long have you done that? Oh, well, if you've run marathons, did you run in Akron's? Have you run in Cleveland's? Have you done the New York? Yeah. What's your dream? You want to run the Boston?
Yeah. What's your time?
Or, I mean, there's ways to just kind of, and you may not know what those,
I mean,
they could totally be BSing you, but who knows? The other thing I would say is around that, I think that interest question can be, you have the potential to overthink it really quickly. Again, like we talked about variety versus vocation. So I am absolutely passionate about mental health and working in the addiction space in my community volunteering. I'm currently serving on a board. But you know what? This year I did a passion project with another organization on this. And next year I may do another passion project on something completely different, but it's still in that space. So as long, I may be flitting from one thing to another, but I'm still consistent in what I'm doing over time. So I think you just have to make sure that as you're asking those questions, you're taking the time to really dig into that person and go, you know, where does this work? Or ask more specifically, oh, it looks like you volunteered with this organization for 5 years. Tell me how do you do that? And then you can dig into, well, are you a weekly volunteer? Are you a monthly volunteer? If you volunteer once a year, does that make you really gritty? Not necessarily. But if you're there consistently and you're running a program or you're volunteering in a consistent program, I think that absolutely can show grit.
So do you think you ought to maybe, because one of the things I'm always looking for with these kind of books is, what the heck should we do with this now? You know, there's some great stuff in there and I'm thinking about my clients or my business or whatever. How am I going to apply this? And a lot of times this stuff is so, it's a little earth shattering, or you're like, oh, wow, that's a big deal, but I have no idea what to do with it. Or it's so broad brushed that practically applying it is almost like you're going to screw it up. You're not going to actually get anywhere because it's too philosophical or theoretical or conceptual almost. And that's what I'm kind of reaching for is, man.
How do you boil it down? What's the one takeaway?
I'd say yes, and to try to get it into, for instance, an interviewing situation, because I know this is a huge deal for business owners where they hire the wrong person, and they hire a person who, they just have a terrible interviewing process.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is going to help somehow. There's some good stuff in here, but I'm trying to figure out how to extract it and turn it into a better interviewing process.
I think if you're trying to do it from an interview process perspective, you would want to, you're creating a consistent process and then you're sticking to it. Mm-hmm. So for me, this book is validation of being honest with yourself and being consistent. And it's not necessarily being excited. Everybody's excited on day one when they start a new project.
Mm-hmm.
It's, can you get to day two? Mm-hmm. Can you get to day three? It's that stick-to-itiveness of embracing the power that mm-hmm. is the yeah. next, day two, that's day 20, that's day 60.
Yeah.
It's not even creating the new process. It's, are you going to freaking follow it?
Yeah.
If you're willing to follow it, then I think that you're going to improve.
Yeah.
So that's my biggest takeaway. It's that consistency of micro decisions every day. They mm-hmm. get you to be a gritty person. Yeah. They get you to be a gritty employer. And they get you gritty employees. But if you're not consistent over time, why is anybody in your organization
going to care?
I mean, I'm following the leadership. I mean, I know that Chrissy may not be in our building every day, but I know that Chrissy is consistently going to answer any emails or any questions that I have, that she's always going to be working on driving the business forward. And I also know that I probably am not going to be able to outwork her because she gets up at 4 a.m.
You do?
Yes.
Shane does too.
Not on purpose.
I do.
It just keeps happening.
We're looking for some medication ideas.
Some relaxium. Oh, I can't say that on there. I'll
have to cut that. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Relaxium.
I'll have to cut that out.
Have you heard that?
I have.
Where have I been? I have not heard of relaxium.
It's on Fox News all the time.
Yeah, it is.
All right. Cut to relaxium. Yep.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm impressed. I know that. Yeah.
Yes.
Marketing.
Yes.
I would say it's being.
Now,
you're doing the same things over time. Okay, what?
Why do you get up at 4 a.m? I mean, I think it's good.
Let's not gloss over this.
If I get up at 4 a.m,
something's
I'm
wrong.
I'm not happy.
So I get up consistently between 4 and 5, depending on what my schedule is. And it is specifically so. I get up, I meditate, I do my affirmation. I do Miracle Morning.
You're working on your headspace.
I'm working on my headspace, my heart space. I'm reading. And then I'm doing exercise. So I also know that is the time where I am by myself. Mm. There is no one is up. No one is bothering me.
What time
do
you go to bed? Like 6?
No. And see, 8:30. this is where at between 9:30 and 10 is usually bed.
So 6 or so.
Which is why I say I get up I'll get up at 5 if I can't get in bed before 10:30.
Okay.
I know that I need a little bit more time. Yeah, I'm monitoring my sleep right now.
Okay. Do you have one of those rings or watches?
I do.
My wife's doing the ring thing. What is that glowy thing? I got this ring.
It's wonderful. And you know what's really great is I can say, you know what happened to my sleep, Steve? You came to bed and rolled around and weren't like sleeping well. So it's a good opportunity. But
So you're blaming that on Steve?
Oh, I totally am blaming part of it on Steve. Because I can tell. Like I go to bed really early and he comes to bed late. And so.
Like what? 1? 12 to 2? Wow.
12 to 2 is his consistent. But now he's starting to get up earlier. So and part of me wants us to have the same schedule, but then part of me doesn't because I need that time by myself in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I get to either 2 AUI or I get to my first appointment, I'm on and I've got to be on the rest of the day. And for someone who's still very much an introvert, I need that quiet time to be able to get myself in the right space. And I would say that one of the reasons why I've been able to accomplish some of the things that I've been able to do is simply because I get up early in the morning. And I didn't start really making the strides and momentum in my career until I mastered my morning schedule.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah,
I've heard a lot of people really tout the value of an early start. And I appreciate it.
Benjamin Franklin said it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he was the first.
Yeah.
I mean, probably not the first one, but the one that I remember.
Jocko Willink is big into that. You know, it's a Navy SEAL thing, all that stuff.
Hal Elrod, if you haven't read Miracle Morning, it's a good book. Mm. Yeah, about getting up consistently. Our daughter does it now too. So we. Oh. Yep.
So does she go to that end of the house, and you go to this end, well, or how do you?
She gets up at 7, so okay. or 6:30. So she's okay. got her half hour that she mm-hmm. does. Mine usually lasts about an hour that I will okay. do all those things. Mm. So
that's great. Well, all right. So if you were to hand this book to somebody, mm-hmm. or if somebody was like, "Hey, Chrissy, I need to get better at learning how to be persistent and persevere and be really driven like you are, mm-hmm. and not quit like you don't," mm-hmm. and you're like, "Well, you should read this book." How would you suggest they dodge the broad brush theoretical and kind of get some really good practical takeaways?
So I think I'm a little more critical of the book than maybe some people are. I don't look at this book as giving me a lot of takeaways as far as how to do things. Mm-hmm. I think it explains the why. Mm. And so if someone says, "Chrissy, why is it so mm-hmm. important?" I think mm. that book so it's explains
conceptual
it really well.
Or,
it's conceptual for yeah, me. Okay. It's not as practical. Yes. But I can see why people would see very practical steps mm-hmm. in the book. Mm-hmm. But I've spent so much time working on those systems and processes in mm-hmm. my life. Mm-hmm. I think that this was more of a concept book yeah. for me. And the book that she references, Mindset by Carol mm. Dweck,
yes.
a fair amount. And yes. that was, I read that a couple mm. of years ago. Mm. And when I'm working on my wow. book, that's some of the research that I've
that's
used.
That's cool. Yeah.
And so I think that it's a great conceptual. Mm-hmm. If someone says, "Why is it so important?"
Okay.
Yeah. Or so why are you able to do the things that you do? Yeah. Because of this, because of consistency.
Yeah. So it's validation.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's the opening for someone who, if you've never had, if you're not a gritty person, I think mm-hmm. it's a great introduction to understand. Mm-hmm. I mean, my grit score is a 4.2. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and I worry about growing grit much higher because I think that would cause me to be a pretty obsessive person. Mm-hmm. So I think that in my past, I've probably been grittier. And I've reduced over time because I think I've gone to therapy. That's helped.
Yeah. So. Yes. That's interesting.
So, yeah, to not that's be a, that, yes. that high achiever, type A, very obsessive work through. So, yeah, that's kind of, yeah. that's what I would think. As I would recommend this book for someone who is trying to figure out, you know, how to be, like, why should I be consistent? What is so special about...
Yeah.
Or like, we talked about the Seattle Seahawks. Why are the Seahawks so great? Why was mm-hmm. Steve Young so great? I mean, like mm-hmm. looking at those mm-hmm. people that achieve mm-hmm. and they're like, "Well, I can never be that person." No, no, no. You absolutely can. And here's the proof, because mm-hmm. it's not about, I mean, yes, talent is important and mm-hmm. it's a small component, but if you don't have the consistency of mm-hmm. effort over time, you're not yes. going to have that success. Yes. And the same thing with tragedy, because sometimes people are like, "Well, a tragedy can just completely just define and you're stuck." And it's mm-hmm. like, you can use tragedy or you can use trauma as a method of refinement, mm-hmm. not necessarily of defining. Mm-hmm. It mm-hmm. refines, it doesn't yeah. define.
Yeah. What was that? And I think Carol Dweck, right? That's her name, mm-hmm. was talking about referring to a study. It's the growth mindset versus the fixed mindset.
Yes.
That was her
yes.
big study, right?
Absolutely.
Kind of saying, "Hey, I can change these mm-hmm. things." It's also really, I think, Adlerian, like the Adler versus, what's his name? Freud.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? Freud's kind of like, I mean, this is a gross over generalization, but Freud's yeah. like, "Oh, yeah, this is how you are. Because mm-hmm. of your folks or whatever." And Adler's kind of like, "Well, yeah, but you can change.
We all have the capacity to change."
Yeah, and that's mm-hmm. the growth mindset
yes.
as opposed to the fixed mindset.
Yes.
And I found that true. I mean, that resonated with me. I found it experientially true, mm-hmm. like where I've been able to change some stuff that I didn't think I could. I thought that was a validation as well. I'd love to read. I would. What's the name of her book?
Mindset. Carol Dweck does. She does a great job. And then another one I think that references Dweck as well. But if you have ever been really angry about a personality test you've ever taken, mm-hmm. Dr. Benjamin Hardy has a book called Personality Isn't Permanent.
I've heard of that.
I love that book. I would say it is less academic than Grit, mm-hmm. Than the Duckworth book. So mm-hmm. if you get into the Duckworth book and you're like, oh, this is a lot of information. Mm-hmm. He breaks things down a little
bit. What's his name again?
Dr. Benjamin Hardy.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember you mentioning that before.
Yeah, I like that one as well. I mean, I think that all three of them, Grit, Mindset, and Personality Isn't Permanent, you could read those three and be set on your mindset and thoughts for the year. Yeah. That should be your 20. If you want to change your mindset in 2023, that should be your three book series. It's my opinion.
Did you have anything in the book where you're like, no, I don't believe you, I don't agree with you, or that's misleading, or that's incomplete, or, you know, I don't think that's what that study meant? I mean, or was there anything you said, I don't care? I don't, you know, did anything make you mad about the book?
I mean, I think there were moments in listening where I thought that she kind of broad brushed some things. I think I said at the beginning, like, work-life balance for me. Mm-hmm. Like, you can be really, really gritty and have a really crappy work-life balance. Mm-hmm. And so I don't, and I think that she did a good job in the last part of the book. I want to say the last chapter, she talks about relationships. She talks about how, you know, it's not always, like, grit is just a component. Yes. So initially when I started reading the book, I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to like this, because I didn't know if it was going to be like, this is the only thing that defines you. And I don't see things just, it's not black and white. I think life has to be multifaceted. So I would say, until she put in the last part about grit and relationships, and sometimes if it's a bad situation, you need to leave. I think that's where there's that component. And I wish she would have written more about grit versus obsession and how there needs to, where the defining line is. Because I think that for some entrepreneurs, for some individuals, that can be a problem. The difference between grit and insanity.
My wife and I, as we were talking about this, because she hasn't read it, but I've just been spouting off about these things as I'm reading stuff. I'm always, you know, chatting about it. But it seems like there's a fine line between, well, grit and OCD.
Oh, absolutely.
Can, like, look similar.
Yeah, and as I think that if I would have read this book in my early life, it would have been permission to be more obsessive. So now as I read it, it's validation for just being intentional and consistent. So I think it's about the time in which you read it. And maybe your personality too, because if you're not a consistently gritty person, or not, that's not the right word. If you're not always consistent in your effort, I think this book hits you harder than it does for someone who's very consistent and very regimented.
And I think that's my experience. I needed some tune-up on consistency. But if I had read it when I was younger, and this just reminded me of this, I would have thought, well, this is my dad. And that's not good.
This is boring. Well, this is authoritative, authoritarian. Yeah,
authoritarian. And this is like he...
I don't want to be that.
Well, it's hard to... You're good at this, but it's hard to criticize a parent and honor them at the same time. That's a fine line. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how to walk that line. I'm going to try right now. But my dad has a hard time. He's in the OCD, at least in my opinion. He's consistent because it freaks him out to not be consistent. And so if I would have read this 20, 30 years ago, I would have said to myself, that's why I'm never going to be like this, because it's this broken way to parent. I was, you know, in many ways, I was parented from an authoritarian. He wouldn't see it that way, but, and that's, you know, giving him a pass, which is cool. I think that's what grace is ultimately. Somebody told me this one time, grace is giving someone more time to get it right.
Yes.
You know, I'm like, oh yeah, okay. Yeah, that's
understanding
cool.
Understanding that they're human.
Yeah, without going, that's okay, because it's not okay.
I'm not saying it's okay.
Yeah. So anyway, I wish she would have spent more time also, rather than kind of this little plug at the end saying, hey, Grit is a part of some bigger, more important stuff.
Yeah. I felt like I would say when you're reading the book, make sure you read the conclusion and really make sure you read that last chapter after the conclusion, because I feel like that was,
yeah.
I don't know if she released the book and got all this feedback and she was like, oh, wait, I need to make sure that we don't do these things.
Yes. Yeah.
I thought it was very valuable because I think for anyone to take, because I think you have the capacity to take this book in a very obsessive way. Yes. As opposed to making it a consistent choice. Like Grit is a consistent choice to continue to do something with excellence and effort, as opposed to, I feel like I have to do this, I should do this, I must do this.
Yeah.
Because if I don't, something bad's going to happen to me. So, I mean, I guess that's, maybe that's how I look at it.
Yeah. Well, so she says at the end here, and this is a conclusion, this is, I don't know what chapter this is, 13 or something. Yeah, 13. That character is plural. As a psychologist, I can confirm that grit is far from the only or even the most important aspect of a person's character. And I'm like, thank you for saying that.
Yes.
Now that's one line, one little paragraph at the one little chapter. I'm like, come on. I think you should have hit it harder.
If she'd have said that at the beginning, I think you would have had far less guilt reading this book.
Yes. In fact, in studies of how people size up others, morality trumps all other aspects of character and importance. Sure, we take notice if our neighbors seem lazy, but we're especially offended if they seem to lack qualities like honesty, integrity, and trustworthiness. And she goes on to kind of say the three virtue clusters are virtues of the will, in which she places grit, virtues of the heart, which are things like moral character, which she says is trumping everything else, and then virtues of the mind, which are things like, she calls it zest and curiosity. She doesn't expand on any of that, hardly. I mean, literally, this is like one page and a half. And I wish she would have taken two chapters to expand on that and broaden the studies and so forth. Yeah. And I know that's not the content of, or the aim of the book, but to me, it would have kind of... Even though I love this thing and it really rocked me, I think it would have been a little more balanced.
I think, Angela, if you're listening, your next book should be balance and talk about those three things.
That's what I'd like.
Yeah, if you would, you could talk about those all together. Hmm. It's just an idea. I mean,
what do you think would be her? I mean, after reading this,
I don't know.
She is writing right now.
She is writing right now. So I'm kind of, there's part of me that's hoping it's more about those three things living together. Yes. Like, how does grit live within will and live within those other qualities?
Yes. Well, in our last episode on this book study, I am going to go back through the book and try to pull out some application, kind of just digest, distill, I don't know. And I feel like that's actually my role in coaching, is to get some of these kind of like stratospheric concepts and put them into like a something you can do practically with them without hurting anybody, maybe, although all tools are can be misused, you know.
Yeah, so sure.
It'd be dangerous, but that's my goal in the last episode of this book study. So I love talking with you about all these things. So our next book that we're going to be doing, when are we doing that? Q1 2023 is, what's the name of it? It's the Lencioni Six Types of Working Genius is going to be our next book study when we're done with this one, which we'll probably start some sessions on that or episodes on that in a couple months, I'm thinking. So nice. You want in?
Sure.
In that?
Right.
Why not?
Are you a Lencioni fan?
I am.
This stuff's good.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Me too. I actually don't. Well, so I know a lot of people appreciate his writing style. I know that you mentioned that you do.
Oh, I love it. My husband hates it. So
yeah. So me and Steve are together. You know, I do appreciate the approach. I get a little distracted because it. I love well, novels and you know, fiction.
Yes.
And
you
so
kind of have a high bar for,
I guess,
story development.
I mean, I think for me, it's that it's just it's church upbringing. I'm so used. Yeah. To, I mean, we learn lesson through story. Mm-hmm. So,
well, for me, I appreciate I'm like, that. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I just think that that kind of story, I just think he didn't, I just think it's too elementary or too, well, almost trite. That I think the dramatic or the metaphoric approach, I just think he should dial it up a little higher. That's all I'm saying.
But sometimes people get lost in the metaphor.
I agree. And I think it wouldn't then serve its purpose, right. And nobody'd learn anything, right. And all that.
Yeah, I mean. Yeah. I think
so, but it's just, again, I mean, it's to me, it's a little distracting. So I try to, I really appreciate what he's teaching. And I think it's a great way to do it. I think it's a great way to show people stuff.
I'm sure there's studies about how people learn through story.
Sure.
But,
and people love his books. I love his books. Mm-hmm. I just tend to get a little... I have to kind of overlook that part of it. It takes a little concentration for me to overlook that part of it, which is fine.
See, these, I would say that the Grit was harder for me because it wasn't as story based. Yes. So I thrive in story based.
Yes, yes, yeah. Well, all right. So great talking with you. What did we say this episode was? 28?
Yeah.
I keep forgetting the number on this one.
That's what happens when you record multiple episodes.
Our book study is in the can. Love to do this. No, this is 29. This is 29.
This is
29.
Are you sure?
No, this is 28.
Yeah,
this is 28.
Okay, you're right.
Josh was 29.
It's 28. I wrote down 29. I screwed that up.
You goof.
Episode 28 is in the can. So, love doing this with you, Chrissy. Looking forward to the next one.
Thank you.
So, all right. Business Broken to Smoking podcast. Helping business owners and leadership teams find and hit their land of awesome. Sometime I'd like to hear what your land of awesome is, okay. By the way.
Happy to do that.
That'd be really cool. So enjoy this book, Grit. We'll see you next time.
Good job.
Hey.
Yeah.
I know. It's a little harder.
I love that part. So good.